upgrade patient results, take care of your personal growth. This is your weekly dose of experts' insight and practical advice. You are listening to the Brain Care Broadcast for chiropractors and practitioners of manual medicine. Your host is Arion Kaprush.
Welcome to another episode of the Brain Care Broadcast. On today's show, we have as our guest Barbara Arrowsmith-Young. She is recognized as one of the pioneers, or also said creator, of the first treatment applications utilizing the principles of neuroplasticity, how the brain can change. And as founder of the Arrowsmith program, she began using these principles as early as 1970-80 to develop cognitive programs to address learning disorders. And she actually started on herself because she had a number of challenges that we will ask her about before we start on the other questions. She has continued to develop programs, the Arrowsmith programs, for students with especially learning disabilities. And her programs of cognitive exercises have been implemented in as many as 55 schools throughout Canada, the US, Australia, and New Zealand. And one of the books she has authored is The Woman Who Changed Her Brain. Welcome, Barbara.
Thank you. It's my pleasure to be here and to discuss what I'm passionate about, which is the brain, how it impacts learning, and its capacity for change.
Can you tell the audience a little bit of the problems you had to overcome and that inspired you to start your journey into changing brains of challenged individuals?
Yes, it began actually for me in grade one, and this was in the 1950s, so I'm dating myself here. When I started school, the belief, I call it the pre-neuroplastic paradigm. The belief was the brain that you're born with is the brain that you die with, and if there's a problem related to learning, basically there's nothing much that could be done about it, that one had to accept one's limitations and live within those, because the belief was the brain was fixed. And so in grade one, I was struggling with learning. I remember overhearing my grade one teacher tell my mother that I had a mental block, because again, this was before the concept of learning disability even existed. There wasn't a term learning disabled. So I envisioned, you know, that I had a wooden cube in my head that made learning difficult. And what the message was at that time was basically learning was always going to be a challenge, that I would never learn like other children, and basically I needed to accept that. And so, I mean, the kinds of difficulties I had, there were a number. What I was later to learn, because I didn't know at that point in grade one that it was, you know, part of my brain or parts of my brain that weren't working, but the outcome was I had tremendous problem processing or understanding information. So if I listened to somebody talking, you know, I could hear the words, but I struggled to attach meaning to them, to really understand. I mean, if something was really simple, like it's raining outside, that I could understand because I could conjure up an image or a picture of rain, or, you know, somebody's, you know, wearing a red dress, that I could understand. But as soon as it got abstract, as soon as there were relational pieces, like even things as simple as before, after, above, below, or something like a fraction, I could understand one because I could see one object. I could understand four because I could line up four objects. But as soon as you put that one over four, which is a relationship part to a whole, I couldn't grasp that. So, you know, I really struggled, and it affected me academically because I struggled with concepts in math, concepts in science, concepts in literature, or reading comprehension. It affected me socially because when people talked to me, if there were, you know, any ideas in what they were saying, I couldn't understand them. And it really made learning difficult. So that was one area. And then there's another part of my brain that registers sensation on the left side of my body wasn't working. So I was incredibly clumsy and awkward. I really didn't know where the left side of my body was in space. I would bang into things. Nobody wanted me to play on their sports team, and understandably so, because I would be tripping over my feet, or if a ball was coming at me, I'd want to run in the other direction because I didn't know where I was relative to that ball, and I was incredibly accident prone. And then I had another area where I couldn't conceptualize three-dimensional space, so I couldn't create maps in my head. And as a child, I would get lost in people's houses because I couldn't imagine how the rooms connected, or something as simple as crossing a street for me held terror, because you create a mental map as you're crossing the street of where you are and where that car is, and whether you're going to be able to get across in time. So I would walk blocks out of my way to find a stop sign or a stoplight to cross. But because of all these difficulties, I've struggled, as I mentioned, academically, socially, and also athletically. So schooling was a place for me that was stressful, incredibly stressful. I developed a lot of anxiety, depression, so all those emotional pieces that go along because I had a cognitive difficulty. And I also got labeled as being rigid, inflexible, and stubborn as a child. And truly, I was all those things, but from a cognitive place, not an emotional place. Because if you can't make connections, I couldn't understand why things happened, like cause and effect. I couldn't compare and contrast. I couldn't weigh alternatives. So I would hold on to things for dear life. I couldn't benefit from insight because you have to make connections. One of the things, I talk about in my work is a lot of times we attribute people's behavior to emotional difficulties. And sometimes that is the case, but a lot of times it's a cognitive problem that impacts that individual's ability to process information and to relate to the world. So that was in kind of long-winded way my beginnings. It's really, school was an incredible struggle. And as I moved through school, I kept having to think there has to be another way. That I didn't see a future for myself. And a lot of the people I work with talk about they stop dreaming at a certain point. Like, they don't dare to dream because they don't see a future for themselves. I didn't see a future. And I was very lucky. Someone gave me a book when I was in graduate school. And I got to graduate school because I did have some areas that were working. I had phenomenal photographic memory, so I could memorize my textbooks. I had an auditory, almost verbatim memory, so when people talked to me, I could memorize what they were saying. I just didn't understand it. And I had incredible drive. And in graduate school, someone gave me a book written by Alexander Luria, the Russian neuroscientist, called The Man with the Shattered World. And it told the story of a Russian soldier who had a very localized head wound, as a result of the war, World War II. And that was this book was this man's story and his journal. And then Luria would explain, that part of the brain. As I read this man's story, I thought, he's living my life and I'm living his life. Like, all the things that he couldn't do after the brain wound, like he couldn't tell time. I was 25, I couldn't read a clock. Because, to interpret a clock, it's a relationship. After this man Zazetsky's wound, he couldn't tell time. He'd been able to do it before. He couldn't understand fractions. He'd been gifted in mathematics before. He couldn't understand those relational words like before and after. And both of us were keeping a journal, obviously different historical periods, and we were using the same language to describe our problems. We were both saying that we lived in a fog where meaning was ephemeral and it would just disappear into a mist. We couldn't grasp it. So this was a huge aha moment for me, because I knew I had a problem, but I didn't know it was with my brain. And to solve a problem, the first step is you have to kind of understand what it is that you're trying to solve. So now I knew it was part of my brain, for whatever reason, hadn't been functioning properly from birth. And so that was the inside of the understanding. And then I was reading at the same time Mark Rosenzweig's work, and he was at Berkeley. In the sort of the late 50s through the 60s and 70s, looking at neuroplasticity, which simply put is that our brain actually is capable of change as a result of experience and stimulation. And he was working with rats, and he demonstrated that if you put rats in a really enriched environment with lots of stimulation, they become better learners. They learned better on mazes than the rats in environments with less stimulation. And then when he looked at their brains afterwards, they had changed physiologically. There were more dendrites, like more of those branches, you know, that allow for more synapses, so better neurotransmission, more neurotransmitters, increased glia cells, enlarged capillaries, so more blood flowing to the area. And he concluded that that enriched stimulation led to physiological brain changes, neuroplasticity, which led to better learning. And at that time, this, I was reading this in 1977, nobody that I was aware of was looking at human neuroplasticity. I mean, probably there were some people somewhere, but it certainly wasn't in kind of the public domain. And I thought, at least I hoped, that humans had as much neuroplasticity as rats. I thought it was safe to assume. And I thought, maybe I could create an exercise for myself, a mental exercise, that would change that part of my brain that wasn't able to process relationships. So that was kind of the journey. It was driven by a hunt for solutions to, you know, very severe learning problems that I had, and then just coming across these two lines of research that were the key pieces that first identified the problem and the nature of the problem, and then it said maybe through the brain's ability to change, if I could find some very targeted activity, I might be able to strengthen that area. And I created the first exercise for myself, having no idea whether it would work or not, but thinking, you know, I have to try because, you know, I was desperate. I just didn't, I didn't see a future for myself. So I created the first exercise, saw the changes in my own functioning after a lot of work. I mean, it's hard work to change the brain. And then I went in and created two more exercises, two very different exercises to address that very clumsy part of me that didn't register sensation, and then saw huge changes there, and then created another set of exercises to work on that three-dimensional representation and saw changes there. So I had been able to create three sort of cognitive programs for three very different areas with three very different outcomes. And then I started working with people. I thought, you know, I could help other people that were struggling with learning, and over a series of years, through listening to the kinds of difficulties, you know, these individuals had, going back into Luria's work, trying to understand what those parts of the brain do, and create exercises, I now have programs, you know, for 19 different cognitive functions. And I'm clear that's not everything that can go wrong with learning. It just is a broad range, both some nonverbal and some language-based numerical auditory memory. The individual can't read social cues, can't navigate. And now I train teachers around the world, and they go back to their schools and work with students with this program. So I guess a lot of description, but that's my journey.
But there was in a very short time, I think you really told the story. And but maybe to put things in perspective, would you have been able to do this interview in your previous condition before you started exercising this?
No, I wouldn't, because it would. What I would have had to do is I would be memorizing, you know, the questions you were asking me, but not sure exactly what you were asking, like what you were really looking for, because I struggle with interpreting. And so, I mean, the short answer is no. I mean, I used to be terrified, say, when I was at university, say, if I got in the elevator with one of my professors, that they would ask me a question, because I knew I wouldn't be able to answer it. I mean, I lived in what I kind of jokingly call amygdala hell. I mean, everything was terrifying. And Luria talks about that difficulty that I had. He said that the person can never verify meaning. They walk around in this constant sense of uncertainty. And that was my life. I mean, I was uncertain about everything. And it was very, very frightening. So I learned to be really, really quiet and smile a lot. Because I figured if I looked pleasant, you know, people would leave me alone. But you know, phenomenal. I live with phenomenal anxiety because, like, that sort of booming, buzzing confusion, that was my world. Like, everything was confusing.
Mm. And that is very profound. And just to think about how many children are there, and also adults that are in a similar situation, even if it will never be the same. You were mentioning also that you, and that this is especially for the listeners, because we work a lot with people that have accidents and run into problems, or there's a lot of people that run repetitively into problems with their body or bump into things. So what you were basically saying, there might be connections with what is happening in the brain also. It's not just a motor program that has gone wrong in the body.
Absolutely. I mean, in my case, I believe it was the, you know, somatosensory cortex, and for me, it was in the right hemisphere because it controls, you know, sensation on the left side. Mm. And I was to the point that, you know, I could put my left hand on a hot burner, and I registered pain, but I didn't register where the sensation was coming from. So I just learned very early that I had to watch my left side of my body. Yeah. To be safe, you know, I once slammed a car door on my head with my left hand and fractured a tooth. I mean, it was significant. That concept of alien hand syndrome. Well, I had alien left side of the body syndrome.
Yeah, you had a hemi neglect. That is, if I may ask, how are you doing now physically? How would you describe the situation now?
I have no problems. I mean, I'm not accident prone. I'm not bruised and banged. Mm. Before, it was really the left side of my body was non-functional. I couldn't pick up a cup of water without spilling it with my left hand. I mean, now I can pick up a China teacup with my left hand, and I'm fine. And by extension, like, once I learned how to drive a car, if I didn't know where the left side of my body was, I didn't know where the left side of that car was. So the left side of my car kind of looked like the left side of my body. It was banged and dented, you know, as a result of that. And I don't have that problem at all today.
That is very, very good to hear, because that is a major and very dangerous situation. Mm-hmm. How well do you feel your work is accepted, even if it is very obvious that you have helped many, many people, especially when you look further into your work?
I think I would say that probably in the last 10 years, there's been much wider acceptance for this kind of work. And I think it's because there's more awareness of neuroplasticity. And I think there are so many more articles being written. It's almost here, certainly in North America, almost on a weekly basis, there's something about the brain and its ability to change. So it's just part of people's awareness now that there is neuroplasticity and the brain is capable of change in a positive direction. And there are other kinds of approaches. I mean, people are looking at neuroplasticity related to pain, neuroplasticity related to mental health issues. So I think I have benefited from that, you know, wider awareness of neuroplasticity, which is what this work was built on. And over time, having all of these results. I mean, when I started the work in 1978, it really was kind of being a voice in the wilderness. I mean, at a certain point, I just really stopped talking about what I was doing because there was so little acceptance and really there was disbelief. And I had to believe at that time that if what I was doing was valid, that I would just amass enough results over the years that eventually the field would catch up and there would be all these individuals out there being able to function in ways they couldn't. So that was where I focused my energy, not trying to convince the field, but by doing the work and developing the programs. And it's played out that way. And right now there are more and more schools that, you know, are approaching me and my staff to talk about, you know, how can we implement this this program. And my real vision is, you know, right now, a school that takes it on, they create a classroom within their school that's a cognitive classroom, and students filter in and out to work on, you know, their difficulties. But I'd love to see a school just in grade one starting with every child in grade one. Part of the day they do cognitive programs, and part of the day they learn, because what do we learn with? We learn with our brain. And I think every child can benefit from cognitive stimulation. And then those children that really need it, say by grade three, might be identified. By grade three, they wouldn't be identified because they would have had that early intervention. So there wouldn't be any stigma around, you know, having a learning difficulty, which now there still is tremendous stigma.
What age would you consider a child to be that it would be right to start assessing this?
We started as young as age five. I mean, around age five, six, and then I've worked with people as old as, I think 81 is the oldest person, because we know there's neuroplasticity.
Oh, yeah.
And I work with a lot of adults that have what I call a cognitive mismatch, right? Where, I mean, they're very intelligent, have, you know, lots of things working well, but they may have one or two components that are kind of out of sync, and it means that in their job performance, they run into some difficulty because their job is calling on those areas of difficulty, like the butcher that had that kinesthetic problem or that, you know, sensory difficulty, and he had a sharp knife in one hand, and he didn't know where his other hand was, so he was cutting himself. I mean, that's what I call a cognitive mismatch. So the best thing was, we, rather than him having to change his career, we addressed the problem. He could register sensation and know where, you know, that part of his body was, and he didn't cut himself anymore.
And this, we are talking about a lot of people, a very high percentage, I think, that have this to a certain extent.
I think so. And I think a lot of, you know, what we attribute to human error, like, you know, when an accident happens, at times it could be this cognitive mismatch where the error is because, you know, whatever happened was calling on a function that the person didn't have at the level that task required.
Yeah. That is very profound for society as a whole, actually.
Yeah.
So how do you think, what can be done to improve the integration of all of this knowledge in a broader way into the school system and into more countries?
Well, I think one of the things certainly I've found has worked very powerfully here in North America and also Australia, New Zealand, is parents advocating for this kind of work. A lot of times parents feel disempowered, but actually the educational system will listen to parents. And so one of the things, you know, that I've recommended is, you know, parents go out and start talking to their school systems, talk to their principals, the teachers. You know, here we have like superintendents of special services, basically start the conversation to say, you know, that our traditional approaches, which come out of that pre-neuroplastic paradigm, and most of the approaches used in special education today, the premise is that learners fixed, and that we have to modify the outside world. Like, we have to modify the curriculum, we have to modify the delivery, but we're not making the assumption that we can actually change the learner. What comes out of neuroscience, which is my work, and I call this a capacity-based program rather than an educational program, because the premise is the learner can be changed. We can actually improve the cognitive capacity of the learner to learn. So I think, you know, parents can go out and knock on the doors of the educators and say, you know what, this is possible, and I would like you to look at some of these programs that are being developed. You know, there's Norman Doidge's book, The Brain That Changes Itself. There's my book, The Woman Who Changed Her Brain. There's a literature out there now to show that this is possible. And it kind of, I think, has to be almost a grassroots level revolution where parents start to demand it for their children. And I think that is really what is going to make the change.
Yeah, because there seems to be a mismatch with what we know from especially the last 20 years of neuroscientific research, and what is implemented in the school. Just last week, we had an interview with Professor Leesman, who was actually talking that it is actually the teaching community that is very slow in catching on and integrating this.
I think we come out of different educational streams. I mean, neuroscience is over here, like looking at the brain and kind of cognitive functions, and education is kind of over there, and really looking at how do we impart knowledge, like how do we teach the individual skills and knowledge. And I mean, to me, there should be a marriage between the two, because you have to have the brain to be able to be educated and to learn. But it came out of different fields with different kind of educational processes, and it's really now to start kind of building that bridge and integrating the research into education.
So where are the Arrowsmith schools or programs going in the future?
Well, my goal would be, I would like to see every school around the world to have what I call a cognitive classroom, like a whether we call it a cognitive classroom, a laboratory, but where students can come in and out for part of the day to work on cognitive programs to strengthen their ability to learn. Because as one parent said, school is just a metaphor for life. These problems don't end at the classroom door. We're going to carry them through life if they aren't addressed early. So, and the beauty of that is, every child would be doing some cognitive programming. So, they might come in for 40-minute period, and then go back into their English class or their science class, and it would be tailored to the needs of each individual. So the amount of time that they might need to spend in that classroom initially is greater, and as their cognitive functions improve, it's reduced until they no longer need the cognitive programs. They can just go on with their schooling, being able to learn efficiently and effectively, and actually to enjoy learning. I mean, the sad thing for me, I hated learning. There was no pleasure in it because it was so burdensome and so hard.
How long, I think it's a very difficult question that I'm going to ask, but how long would a typical pupil or student spend in a Arrowsmith program or in a re-educational program to improve cognition?
It's usually a 3 to 4 year program. And when we go into a school and start working with the school, initially for the students that we're first working with, these are the ones that have learning challenges or learning difficulties, we require a half day per day of cognitive programming. So that the first few years, and then it's the child's improving, and every year they improve on the areas they're working on. Over time, that is reduced until they don't need any of the cognitive programming. Like, it's not something they have to do for the rest of their life, because what I believe is once the brain is changed and those areas are functioning normally, then it just, those areas of the brain start to get their own stimulation by being used effectively within the neural network. And I've tracked people over 30 years out of the program, and what we see is there's no drop-off in cognitive function. Once the gains are there, have them. So typically, a student will spend about half a day initially in the cognitive classroom, and somewhere on average of 3 to 4 years. But after that, they never look back, and the rest of their lives, they have those capacities that they can use for all aspects of learning, for relationships, social relationships, in their career. So it's a small investment in time initially, for the rest of the person's life.
Yeah, that is the great thing about the brain. Unlike any other body part, once it starts integrating, you keep strengthening it and start involving it in the activities that you do. So what at the moment gets you the most excited or passionate in the work that you do?
For me, it's hearing the transformation of all of these students, from as young as 5, as I said, to as old as 81. I mean, that's what drives me, you know, is hearing the stories of what these students struggled with initially and, you know, now what they can do, and basically the world of possibilities that opens up for them. I mean, a lot of the adults I work with say that their careers were chosen for them. Mm. Because of their learning difficulties, there were so few doors that were open. So, you know, there might be one or two doors, and that was their choice. And now what this work allows them to do is have a broader range of choices, and it allows them to competently, you know, engage with those choices. I talk about self-confidence, like healthy self-confidence based on real competence, because, you know, somebody can tell you you're amazing and wonderful, but if every day you walk into school where that's not your experience, you know, it's going to erode your self-confidence. These students now have the capacity, you know, to function, to engage, to learn, to relate. And that leads to really healthy self-confidence because it's based on real experience. So I think that's what keeps me driven. I feel like I've been given the task to represent all of these individuals that are struggling and to, you know, try to shift education to give them a different possibility.
Wow. So looking back, what other than that, of course, you would have liked to start earlier with reprogramming your own brain. What would you say, what life lesson has learned you the most, and what did you wish you had known in the past that you know now?
Oh, gosh. Well, I mean, certainly growing up, I wished, you know, there'd been, you know, someone like me ahead of me that would have changed all those struggles, but then I wouldn't have invented this work, right?
No.
If I hadn't had the struggle. So it's one of those sort of catch-22s. So, you know, I wish I hadn't had as much suffering as I had growing up, but that's what drove me to create this work. So I guess a mixed blessing. That would be, you know, the main thing, but there's, just how it was. And I think, you know, my message to, you know, parents would be listen to your children. Because a lot of children, when I was doing interviews for my book, I interviewed a lot of students, and what they said, almost all of them, and I know from my own experience, and actually the research supports this, is we try to keep our problems hidden because there's a lot of shame around feeling inadequate, feeling incompetent, and even our parents don't know the degree of struggle that we're experiencing because we don't want to be a burden. So, I mean, the message I would have is, you know, if your child is exhibiting some struggles in school, have a courageous conversation with them. Like, sit down and really openly listen to their difficulties, because I would have longed for that. I would have longed for somebody to say, I understand how hard it is, rather than saying, go out there and try again, you know, and have a stiff upper lip. I would have really liked someone to see my struggles and validate them, because that's part of the healing process.
Yeah, and especially as parents or as adults, when we have not had these tremendous struggles, it's very hard to comprehend that maybe even our peers or children have to deal with it, because they are very capable of covering it up, like you very eloquently told how you did And actually, I think Malcolm Gladwell, in one of his latest books, David vs. Goliath, actually said something about what you referred to earlier, that maybe your struggles being in a disadvantage when you started out has actually led that you are doing this work. So there's always more sides to it. But I guess you would never wish this to anyone.
Yes, I wouldn't. And truly believe, you know, I believe in focusing on the positive. And I think maybe that's also what, you know, was part of the driving force. So So for me, the positive was that out of this incredible struggle grew this work that's really very transformative. So that's what I focus on.
Yeah. So the brain needs obviously stimulation in any form, like learning, and but it also needs like nutrition and oxygen, and like physical exercise has been known to really drive the brain and grow and develop, especially when we are young. How do you see this in the work that you are doing, physical exercise, nutrition?
I think they're really very, very important. I think for the work that I do to be as effective as it can be, we need to ensure that those kind of general factors relating to brain health are in place. So we certainly recommend, good nutrition. We recommend, good physical exercise, even mindfulness. Like we integrated mindfulness practice in meditation into the school because there's research showing the positive benefits of that. So anything that will, and sleep. I mean, there's a lot of research looking at the negative effect of sleep deprivation. Yeah. So anything that keeps the brain in a healthier state will only be good for the individual, and it will be positive for this work because it will be like a more rich neuroplastic environment that we're working with. So we do a lot of education and encouraging families and students to look at all those factors.
So most of our listeners, they work with patients, and they some of them see many children, or of course also children with learning difficulties or developmental difficulties. Would you have any advice for them where to find more information for themselves and for their patients?
Well, certainly more information about my work. We have a lot of information on my website. It's arrowsmithschool.org. It lists a lot of sort of the descriptions of the different areas that we work on. Sometime in the next couple of months, we're going to have sort of a questionnaire that will be a self-diagnostic process that people can go answer the questions, and it will give a learning profile at the end to say, based on your responses, it looks like these cognitive areas are, the ones that are leading to some of the challenges that they're experiencing. So, at some level, that will give insight into an individual's challenges, which I think is a positive thing. I mean, to have insight and awareness of your strengths and weaknesses can only be positive. In terms of the programs that I've developed, I mean, right now, just because of the nature of them, they're not available online, whether that will be something that we can do down the road. I mean, really, the kind of model that I've used to deliver the program is to work with schools, to work with educators. We have a training institute in Toronto, which is where I'm from in Canada, where we bring teachers from around the world, train them, they go back into their school system using the program. We have staff in Toronto that, work over the web, with these teachers to support them, because my commitment is always to the student that's engaging with these cognitive exercises to ensure that they're getting the best possible delivery. And how can I do that? Is by supporting the teacher that's delivering it. And also in my book, there's a lot of detailed description of, again, the different cognitive functions. And in each chapter, it's sort of a different part of the brain and how a strength or weakness there will play out. And then there's a little exercise someone can do to kind of get a sense as to, if they have a difficulty, what would it feel like? And it's a bit of a description of sort of the nature of the exercise, but it's a very complex system that I've developed, and I believe it has to be complex because the brain is complex, and so it's not something that I can put in a book with five easy steps.
No. I think all of the people listening understand that. And the book you are referring to, with all the different areas and the specific problems and some of the things you might do to start remediating, that is described in The Woman Who Changed Her Brain.
That's correct.
Yeah, and the site where they can find more information was www.arrowsmithprograms.
Cool. Arrowsmithschool.org. So it's arrowsmithschool.org.
Okay. Well, I think that will be very helpful. And I think you have sparked a lot of interest by giving this interview. And are there any things you feel that other health professionals might be more aware of or can contribute to making people more aware of these problems?
I think, again, having more insight into some of these different cognitive functions is always useful. I mean, I don't know if you know Norman Doidge's The Brain That Changes
Itself. It's a brilliant, brilliant book.
Yes, and he's here in Toronto. I mean, he's a research psychiatrist here. Mm. He got interested in this field he was interested in this field before he met me, but in 2000, he came across my work, and he started referring some of his patients that were coming to him for, you know, emotional problems, and as he listened to them, he thought, this feels cognitive. Mm. And so he would send them to me, we would work on the cognitive areas, and he would watch their shift therapeutically. Mm. And what he found was, which I knew from my work, is that with a certain cognitive problem, these people would get stuck in therapy because they couldn't make connections or benefit from insight. And so I think, you know, if I'd say anything is, you know, to really compassionately listen to your clients as they're describing their problems and maybe think about the cognitive benefit. I mean, this is the next book that I want to write, is, you know, how do these cognitive difficulties play out in terms of our personality? Because a lot of problems that we're attributing to emotional difficulties may be cognitive. And if we don't address the cognitive, we can't address the emotional. So I think, like, you know, deep, compassionate listening to the people that you're working with to get to the root of their problem.
Yeah, and it is, like you say, it is the cognitive, emotional aspects and the physical aspects. In reality, if you look at how the brain evolves, they are all one and the same system. So I think you are very right in saying that the cognition and emotional control have much in common. Barbara, thank you so incredibly much for granting this interview, and I think we, when I speak for myself, learned a tremendous deal and certainly taste your passion for this subject. And I really hope you would like to come back in a later broadcast to tell more about your fascinating work. But for now, we will say goodbye and hope to have you back on the show.
That would be my pleasure, and thank you for a delightful interview.
You have been listening to another episode of Brain Care Broadcast, New Frontiers in Manual Medicine and Chiropractic. Put in practice for best results, and stay tuned for next week's episode.